It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
We just had the first several-inch snowfall event in New York City in over 2 years this last week, and many of us were very excited about it, including myself. But forecasting this event was not an easy task, and the information leading up to the event was confusing and in some cases changed drastically 24 hours before the storm began moving up to the Northeast coast. Snow is one of the hardest things to predict when it comes to the weather. But my next guest loves that challenge. Tom Nizzle has been fascinated with snow since his childhood days in Buffalo, New York. Coming from one of the snowiest places on earth, he developed a passion for the winter season and all things related to frozen precipitation in his 40-plus year career. Tom joined Fox Weather in December of 2022 as our winter storm specialist, and we are so happy to have him. Please welcome Tom Nizzle to the Janice Dean podcast. Tom Nizzle, you made the Dean's list.
I guess so. That is wonderful. Once in my life, I've made it.
Oh, stop it. I don't believe it for a second. Were you not like the smartest kid in your class?
Not quite, but I got to hang around with a lot of smart kids, and that was good.
When did your love of weather happen?
Oh my, like most weather geeks, it was as a child. I was born and raised in Buffalo, New York, in one of the snowiest areas in the entire United States. And I had a love of snow and weather overall from when I was about that age.
So you can remember, listen, I grew up in Canada and I remember snowstorms where I would wake up and the snow would be as high as my rooftop.
Yeah, and I
grew up as a kid, a snow-loving kid, in the decade of the 60s, and there were 3 or 4 winters during that time frame in the Northeast that were extremely snowy, and so that's the memory that's cemented into my head. That's how I remember winters.
Oh, me too. And I get excited about it. I mean, listen, you are our winter specialist, but there is something very special about snow. What do you think it is?
Oh, to me, it's otherworldly.
And I like to tell the story about bringing people up from the tropical regions of this globe to experience winter, the winter landscape, falling snowflakes, all of that for the first time in their lives. They have to think that they're on another planet.
It's so true. Now, let's talk about this last storm system that brought, you know, 3 inches to New York City, which is nothing to sneeze at. But for a city that hasn't had snow in 2 years, over 2 years, this was a pretty big event for us. What do you attribute that to?
Well, it typically has to do with the large scale weather patterns that develop on a seasonal basis across North America. But what's interesting, and from the meteorological chat that I see with all of my colleagues, is New York City and that area around the city itself seems to be in this snow drought compared to even areas close by over the past 3 years or so. And it's really, we're trying to get our head around this. What is actually happening to cause that? Is it just coincidence? Well, certainly there's been an overwhelming pattern that has been much warmer than normal in the New York City area, in the Northeast in particular, for the past couple of winters, right? And I always say it takes two to tango. If you want snow, you need two ingredients. You need moisture and you need cold air. Now, this winter, it's been moist. It's been very wet across the Northeast. From December 1st through now, the departure in precipitation has been 5 to 7 inches above normal. So we've gotten all the moisture we want. We just can't get the cold air down into this part of the country, the Northeast, when we get these storms that track through.
Mm-hmm. But this one had dynamic cooling. So tell me about this incredible phenomenon.
Yes, the magic of the atmosphere. It is fascinating when you look at it. Dynamic curling refers to a process where essentially you're not bringing cold air in from north, from Canada or places like that to produce the snow. The weather system itself is so strong, it cools the atmosphere above it. And there's some complicated processes, but to try to boil it down quickly, essentially you get very strong upward motion in these storms. And when air rises, it cools very rapidly. That's part one. It cools the atmosphere down. So now that column of air above you cools. Snow falls, and it gets down to about 3,000-5,000 feet above the ground. It's still above freezing. So the snowflakes melt. Ironically, when you change snow to liquid, that takes energy to do that process. And that energy comes from robbing heat in the atmosphere. So the process of snow melting as it falls actually cools the atmosphere. And we saw that the temperature in Central Park the night before the snow began was in the low 40s. As soon as the snow began, the temperature dropped through the upper 30s down to the mid 30s and the low 30s in a period of about 4 hours. Mm. So we actually watched that process right in front of our eyes.
Mm-hmm. This storm was interesting because basically 24 to 36 hours beforehand, we were thinking, okay, a slushy inch or two. And then all of a sudden, we saw that process and the National Weather Service was like, you know, there's going to be some dynamic cooling going on. We maybe need to up our snowfall totals. You know, people give local forecasters a tough time. I mean, I always say I feel blessed that I'm not a local forecaster because we don't want to get it wrong. That's the last thing we want. But these guys have to take it on the chin because in some cases you're doing, you know, you're now casting. You're actually forecasting as it happens.
That's correct.
Janice, weather forecasting is a humbling profession. I work the forecast desk for 25 years up in Buffalo, New York at the National Weather Service office there. And every storm brought its own issues. It is not an exact science. And in this case here, 2 days before the event, we were looking at a heavy swath of snowfall about 100 to 150 miles north and west of where it actually came down. And there were two factors that came into play to develop this storm up in the atmosphere. One was a storm system itself going across the southern plains. The computer models had a pretty good handle on that, but they were treating this as a little stronger system. And in effect, the system was just a little weaker and faster moving as it slid across the plains. The second feature was an upper level trough in southern Canada. These two features helped to modulate each other. And early on in the forecast process, the computer models didn't have a good handle on that northern system. They weren't sampling it well enough to really identify it. And as a result of that, they were keeping this band of snow further north. It wasn't until 12 to 24 hours before the actual event that that Mother Nature kind of showed its cards, and the models were able to lock into a forecast that was much closer to what actually happened.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I saw a couple of local forecasters, Eric Fisher being one of them from Boston, talking about that busted forecast or, you know, the forecast that they thought they were going to have and how the totals went up. And I appreciate that, you know, as a meteorologist. And I think the audience does, too, you know, because I don't think they understand what you just explained, all the dynamics and the variables that have to go into forecasting an event like this. I think there needs to be more of that.
Well, there certainly does. There certainly needs to be more education because there are new processes and technologies that have come on board from a forecast process that help define the uncertainty within these storms. And it is something called probabilistic forecasting. The chances that something is going to occur. When you dig deeper into the pages of the National Weather Service offices, you will see these forecasts. The forecast for New York City, even 24 hours before the event, was going for about an inch of snow.
in and around the Big Apple itself. But there were probabilities, chances, low chances, albeit, but chances in about the 20 to 30% range. So 2 out of 10 times something like this would happen, you actually could get more like 5 to 8 inches of snow. When people look at these probabilities, and if they have a basic understanding of how that works, they can get a better idea of what the odds are that you could go from one end to the other in snowfall. And departments of transportation, school districts, these types of entities use these probabilistic forecasts these days to give themselves an idea of when they pull the trigger on maybe canceling school, maybe putting more trucks out onto the streets before these events occur. So we've come a long way, but boy, we've got a long way to go yet.
Mm-hmm. And snow really is one of the hardest things to forecast.
Oh my gosh. You know, I've worked with specialists over the years, tropical specialists, summer weather specialists and that. And we always joke about, back and forth as colleagues. I tell them, look, all you have to do is predict where the rain is going to fall. When you get into the wintertime, you not only have to predict where the precipitation comes down, you have to predict 4 potentially different types of precipitation: rain, sleet, freezing rain, and snow. And by the way, they can all occur within a band of about 50 miles. So it is a big challenge.
Tell me about those differences in precipitation when it comes to that wintry mix, quote unquote.
Yeah, and that all has to do with the structure of the temperature above us in the atmosphere, that column of air above us. It isn't in a typical atmosphere, the air cools. As you go up, it gets colder. You look into mountainous areas, that's where the snow is the heaviest because it's coldest there. But each weather system has its own personality. And within that column of air, as these rotating weather systems, these big cyclonic features, low pressure systems, move from the south up to the north, they can actually bring little slices or little layers of warmer air up above that cold air at the surface. And if you get a layer of warmer air in the wintertime, snowfall starts up high in the atmosphere. It can drop through that layer and melt. And then as it gets back into the cold air, it can either refreeze into little tiny particles of ice called sleet, or if that cold air of layer of air is very shallow, when those snowflakes melt, they then hit a shallow layer of cold air. There's not enough time for them to freeze, but everything down on the ground, all those surfaces below 32 degrees, when they get that liquid precipitation to hit those surfaces, it immediately freezes and changes into this dangerous layer of ice. And that is one of the biggest challenges in forecasting winter weather, is where that type of precipitation is going to occur.
Mm-hmm. It really is. It's incredible how I sometimes wonder how they do it, especially the meteorologists that have to help out school districts or sports complexes or, you know, government officials to let them know when they have to shut down the roads. That is a tremendously stressful situation.
Well, it is. And again, with my decades of experience in the National Weather Service, one of our most important jobs, and it's really come to the forefront in the last decade, is what we refer to as decision support services. We are there to help guide departments of transportation, counties, cities, those government entities on how the winter weather is going to unfold. And typically, National Weather Service offices will conduct conference calls with these entities to brief them before these events occur. And in most cases, they are well prepared for all of the potential impacts we can see from these storms. But again, Mother Nature holds the cards here and can throw some great curveballs at us. And so it's not a cut and dry process.
And we'll be back with more of the Janice Dean podcast right after this.
Precise, personal, powerful. It's America's weather team in the palm of your hands. Get Fox weather updates throughout your busy day, every day. Subscribe and listen now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
How do you think AI will affect our forecasting, good or bad?
Oh, I think it's going to be a big improvement and the ability to provide forecasting, because it is going to do a lot of the work that typically has to be managed by the human element within this forecast process. Now, AI is in its infancy right now, and a lot of what AI is adding to the meteorological process is more of a basic process that artificial intelligence and machine learning will provide in all of these different areas of science and even society. But it is expanding very, very rapidly now, and it's being refined. And there are many research projects going on now within the meteorological community. A lot of this was talked about at the latest American Meteorological Society meeting about how AI and machine learning is going to be incorporated into this process with basic computer modeling to advance the field of weather forecasting. I'm really excited to see how this is going to unfold.
Mm-hmm. But I feel like we also need people like yourself who have had, you know, decades of experience that, you know, even though the computer modeling is good, it's getting better, we have, you know, this technology, there is something to be said for that human memory or the moment of experiencing something and going, but wait a minute, I remember a snowstorm back when, and we had these types of dynamics, and this is how it unfolded.
Oh, that's, there's certainly all, I'll use the term always with quotes around it, but there will always be a place for the human mind, the human brain, the human process within that forecast process. First and foremost, in my mind, is communication. And you and I know this all too well. When I was an intern forecaster back in the National Weather Service decades ago, I remember my lead forecaster looked at me one day and he said, "Listen, young man, you could be a PhD and you can write the best forecast you have ever written, the best of anybody in the world. But if you can't communicate that forecast to the public, it's not worth the paper it's written on." Mm. And that has always stuck with me. The ability for us as weather forecasters and presenters in broadcast meteorology in particular to communicate the uncertainties, to communicate how the storms are going to unfold, all of that information to the public who really doesn't have the time to go to school and get a PhD in meteorology, I think that is extremely important. That's number one in the human machine mix that we see now and going into the future. But there's a lot more from there as well.
Amen, my friend. I agree. I've met a lot of smart people. But like yourself, you know, you try to explain it to the general, you know, population. This is really tough science stuff that it requires a lot of crazy math and, you know, technical terms. And I really do appreciate your delivery. Like for you to, you know, explain what dynamic cooling is, you know, the general population understands that. And that is definitely an art form and a gift that you have.
Well, again, it's taken decades of that. And, you know, I like you and most scientists, you know, we've had this inbred curiosity since we were little kids. I not only like winter weather, I love nature. I live in a place now where I'm out hiking in the woods every day. And my curiosity on everything from nature just continues to expand. And so from a meteorological standpoint, part of what is in our DNA is not only to experience it, but to share that enthusiasm with the public. And that's where I have so much fun when I'm on air talking about the latest winter storm, my winter expertise is lake effect snow, those types of things. I also love to photograph snow crystals. Mm. And so I enjoy even that. It's that kid that continues to come out at us through all the decades of our experience.
Lake effect snow is your specialty. That is one crazy phenomenon, my friend.
I could talk about that for hours, but simply put, to, you know, I lived in a place where we received on average 150 inches of snow each winter. And, you know, I could be in my yard where there's 3 feet of snow and then travel 10 to 15 miles north of me to where the grass is green from one of these narrow, intense snow bands. It is the most intense snow on a small scale that you will see on the face of the earth. And the Great Lakes are these great natural laboratories to study that produce this. And it doesn't only occur in the Great Lakes. I love to watch the sea effect snows that occur off the Sea of Japan around the world. And at the latitudes where we can get these conditions, they do occur around the entire globe. But Buffalo, New York, they're the heart of the heaviest lake effect snow that you will see in a populated area in the entire world.
Wow. Listen, I went up and saw Punxsutawney a couple weeks ago, and he prognosticated that we were in for an early spring. What is your thought on that forecast?
Well, at the outset, I'm going to tell you, and this may be an easy out for me, but I am not a proponent of seasonal forecasting when we get into the details. I still think there's a tremendous amount of research going on that has improved seasonal forecasting. But time and time again, when these types of very complicated forecasts are boiled down to the public, it's boiled down way too simply to show the public what the uncertainties are with that type of forecasting. That being said, I'm looking more at sub-seasonal timeframes going into the latter part of January and early March. I correspond often with a colleague of mine, Dr. Judah Cohen at AER Research, who's probably the best seasonal forecaster out there right now with the new technologies he uses. They're looking at what may be another big cool down in the latter part of January and early March across the eastern U.S., eastern part of North America. And, you know, for those of us who are winter weather lovers, we still keep our fingers crossed. We may see one or two more good storms, but we are in getting toward the latter part of February now. The sun angles are getting quite high. So the chances of getting something like this to stick around for a long period of time certainly are going to quickly go by the wayside.
I like the way you think. I mean, forecasting past 5 days is very, very tough. And to give a seasonal forecast, hurricane forecasts, I understand. It's almost like this is your PSA to get ready if you live along the coast or an area that can be affected by hurricanes. I understand why they do that. But to be able to forecast something past 7 days is pretty tough. So I concur with you there. You know, you can look back at history and weather trends and jet streams and all that, but we really don't know.
Well, and to the point of the researchers and what they have been able to uncover and advance with in seasonal forecasting, we had an El Nino. We've had an El Nino set up over the globe, the equatorial Pacific, for this winter that typically produces certain types of weather across the United States, generally milder weather. And we have had that across the U.S., generally drier weather as you get into the mid-Atlantic and the east. It's been anything but dry. In fact, it's been exceptionally wet. And so these large-scale features on a global basis, El Nino, the polar vortex, ice cover in the Arctic, snow cover in Siberia, the NAO, I can go on and on and on. The MJO and other factors all operate to modulate the weather on a very large scale over different timeframes. And the key to being able to improve that forecasting is how to understand how all of these factors come together to produce what occurs over a typical season in different parts of the globe.
So well said. Thank you so much for being on the program. I admire you. I have for many years. You do a tremendous job. And how's Fox Weather treating you, by the way?
Oh, my gosh. It's been so much fun. Let me tell you, to be there with all those enthusiastic meteorologists who get to geek out like I do in a very, very professional organization. When I was first introduced to Fox Weather and their launch a couple of years ago, you know, there's always trepidations with going into a business like this. And let me tell you, they have done it right. The people that they have there in all levels of support at Fox Weather are absolutely the best. And I'm having a wonderful time being able to work with them. And I hope I can continue that for another few years.
Okay. Well, you're doing great work, my friend. Do you still have your blog, by the way?
Yes, I do. I blog once in a while with that. But again, being on Fox Weather now, I'm kind of involved with a lot of what goes on with day-to-day weather. So I get back to that once in a while. And you'll see my blog. It's allweather.blogspot.com. And just Google that and you'll see some of my recent articles. The last one I did was a review of that amazing snowstorm in Buffalo, New York, back in the Christmas of 2022. That was a really tough storm.
Yes.
And I've got an interesting article about that.
Okay, good. Yeah. You know, government officials could take a page out of what meteorologists do, and that is if there's a forecast and a storm that is particularly bad, really any forecast, we will always do an after action review. We go back and try to find out what went wrong so that we do better the next time. And for that storm in Buffalo, which we all remember, killed many people. I remember driving home for Christmas and we had to avoid that storm because we go see my mom and we have to drive through Buffalo. And we were watching the forecast very carefully. But that's a good example of weather people really as a community wanting to do better the next time. And I think that a lot of people could learn from that.
Well, when we come, if I get to come back and be on the block with you again, or on the podcast with you again, I've done an article on what defines a weather catastrophe and what separates that from typical garden variety high impact weather. And maybe we could address that if I come back again.
Well, that is a guarantee, my friend. That's going to happen. So stay tuned. I'm going to give you a call and we'll set that up.
Sounds great.
Tom Nizel, thank you so much, my friend.
Oh, it's great to be here. And thank you for having me. And think snow, everybody.
Yes, I'm team snow as well. Thanks to Tom for coming on today. Isn't he awesome? His passion for the weather is infectious. And I know he inspires all of us here at Fox News and Fox Weather. P.S. I'm really hoping we get more snow in the forecast the next couple of weeks. But that's just me. You can catch Tom on Fox Weather as a contributor and our winter storm specialist. You can also see Tom blog about his weather passion at itsallweather.blogspot.com. And if you don't have it already, I highly recommend downloading the Fox Weather app. It's easy to use, and you can plan your upcoming trips and have several cities to choose from when you're looking for a forecast. The 3D radar is awesome, and you can watch the broadcast streaming live as well. It's foxweather.com. Thank you to all of my listeners. If you have someone you think should make the Dean's List, let me know at Janice Dean on Twitter or Janice Dean FNC on Instagram. Or you can rate this podcast. Please subscribe, rate, and review to this podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or at foxnewspodcast.com. Listen ad-free with a Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts. And Amazon Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app. And don't forget to spread the sunshine.
Put the power of over 100 meteorologists and the worldwide resources of Fox in your hands with the Fox Weather Podcast. Precise, personal, powerful. Subscribe and listen now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.